This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Friday, the 31st of March, these are our main stories. A New York grand jury votes to indict the former US President Donald Trump. Finland will become the 31st member state of the North Atlantic Military Alliance, NATO, after the Turkish parliament voted to back its application to join. And a warning from the outgoing head of the World Food Programme.
We don't have enough money, Sarah. We have to choose which children eat, which children don't eat, which children live, which children die. Syria, we're running out of money there. I can go on and on where we're running out of money.
Also in this podcast, South Korea accuses North Korea of publicly executing some citizens just for watching foreign films. And remembering Procol Harum's Keith Reed, who's died at the age of 76. And we start in the US, where the former President Donald Trump has been indicted by a Manhattan grand jury after a probe into hush money paid to porn star Stormy Daniels. He therefore becomes the first US president to face criminal charges and, of course, is making another run for the White House in 2024. Our Washington correspondent Gary O'Donoghue told me more.
We don't have any detail about the specific charges yet. We just have confirmation from a number of sources that the grand jury in New York, in Manhattan, has voted to indict Donald Trump in connection with that payment, as you were mentioning, to Stormy Daniels before the 2016 general election here. Now, you'll know that Donald Trump has been whipping up his supporters in recent days, not just about the prospect of being charged, but personal attacks on the district attorney in New York himself, Alvin Bragg. I mean, Alvin Bragg is a black man, and Donald Trump has called him a racist, has called him an animal, and has called on his supporters to protest if the charges were brought. So everyone's holding their breath here to see what happens next. What definitely happens next, Alex, is that Donald Trump will have to go to New York and he'll have to be booked. And what that means is...
A perp walk, in other words.
Well, possibly a perp walk. That doesn't always necessarily happen. I don't know how many of our listeners understand a perp walk, but perp is perpetrator, and it's when they're paraded before the cameras in handcuffs. But he may not end up in handcuffs, but he will have to go to the district attorney's office, have his mugshot taken, have his fingerprints taken, and have his DNA swab taken. And then he'll have to enter a plea before a judge, which is a court in the same building as the DA's office. So for Donald Trump, this will be humiliating. No question.
But is it good news or bad news for his presidential bid? I know that sounds like a weird question, but it could go either way.
It's exactly the right question because it's both. It's the way I see it, the way I talk about it, is this is jeopardy and opportunity. Sure, being charged with a crime is a real problem, whoever you are, let alone the former president of the United States. But it is something we know that gets his supporters riled up, gets them backing him, gets them sort of excited and motivated. So both of these things are true. And bear in mind, one last thought before you let me go. These aren't the only criminal investigations that are looking into Donald Trump. In many ways, this is the least serious of the potential criminal charges he could face in the long run.
And Gary, just in 10 seconds, could he, if he were behind bars, does that disbar him from the White House?
No, someone ran for the White House in the 1940s from prison.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. And after I spoke to Gary, Donald Trump released a statement. He says this is political persecution and election interference at the highest level in history. I believe this witch hunt will backfire massively on Joe Biden. This story will develop, I'm sure. The Turkish parliament has ratified Finland's membership of the NATO military alliance. Finland ended decades of military non-alignment and decided to join NATO last May following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Our security correspondent Frank Gardner reports.
This decision clears the way for one of the most important moments in NATO's history. Finland, a country with an 800-mile border with Russia and one of the most powerful arsenals of artillery pieces in Western Europe, is ditching its neutrality and joining the alliance. For President Putin, it's a major strategic setback. He sent his army into Ukraine last year in the expectation it would check NATO's expansion and weaken the West. In fact, it has achieved the exact opposite. Finland is now set to become the seventh NATO country on the Baltic Sea, further isolating Russia's coastal access at St. Petersburg and on its small enclave of Kaliningrad. Russia's foreign ministry earlier condemned Finland's decision, saying it was ill-considered and based on Russophobic hysteria. But Finnish public opinion, and ultimately its decision to join NATO, has been radically altered by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Finland simply believes it stands a better chance of not being invaded by Russia if it joins the Western alliance.
Frank Gardner. The White House couldn't have been more forthright in its condemnation of the arrest of an American journalist in Russia on suspicion of spying for the United States. Evan Gershkovich from the Wall Street Journal was arrested in the city of Yekaterinburg, where he was investigating the mercenary group Wagner, which is fighting alongside Russian troops in the war in Ukraine. On Thursday, he appeared in court in Moscow at a hearing held behind closed doors. Mr. Gershkovich, who's accused of gathering classified information on Russia's defense industry, denies any wrongdoing. The White House spokesperson Karine Jean-Pierre condemned Russia's actions and called on Americans to leave Russia.
This espionage charges are ridiculous. The targeting of American citizens by Russian government is unacceptable. We condemn the detention of Mr. Gershkovich in the strongest terms. We also condemn the Russian government's continued targeting and repression of journalists. I want to strongly reiterate that Americans should heed the U.S. government's warning to not travel to Russia. U.S. citizens residing or traveling in Russia should depart immediately, as the State Department continues to advise.
Chuck Schumer, the majority leader in the U.S. Senate, said the journalist had fallen victim to the Russian president's war with Ukraine.
Putin plays all these little games of bluffing and brinksmanship, and this is another one. But to have an innocent journalist be held hostage for that is really despicable, and I am urging the administration to do everything they can to get him free.
He is the first journalist from a U.S. news outlet to be arrested on espionage charges in Russia since the Cold War. Jason Kokoran is a freelance journalist who was based in Moscow for several years and knows Mr. Gershkovich.
It is a shocking development because up until now, foreign journalists have really been, you know, sort of not fair game. The focus and the pressure has been on Russian journalists. But now that seems to be changed with Evan's arrest. He's a really dedicated journalist. He made his name at the Moscow Times with some fantastic scoops, particularly on the poisoning of Alexei Navalny, the opposition figure, and also with Russia's misreporting of the pandemic statistics over the last couple of years. And he so impressed people with his reporting that the Newswires, the Wall Street Journal, and the AFP hired him. He's the son of Soviet immigrants, so he speaks fluent Russian. He has a great understanding of the country and a great respect for the country and its people.
Our correspondent in Washington is Anthony Zerka.
The Biden administration has condemned the detention and said that this is yet another example of Moscow's cracking down on journalists and the free press in general, and reached out to the family of the detainee and is trying to have official communication with Moscow, but they have not revealed any evidence of that communication or any result of it so far. This is a sign that depths of relations not seen since the Cold War, which also was the last time an American journalist in Moscow in Russia was accused of espionage back in 1986.
Anthony Zerka in Washington. They helped to move millions of dollars into Swiss bank accounts for a friend of President Putin. Now, four bankers have been fined by a Zurich court for not asking more questions when Sergei Roldugin deposited $30 million in the Swiss branch of Russia's Gazprom Bank between 2014 and 2016. The bankers, three Russian and one Swiss, say they will appeal against the court's decision. Imogen Folks, the BBC's Geneva correspondent, told me more about their conviction.
They've been convicted of failing to apply with Switzerland's what's called due diligence laws around banking. And what that means is that this particular individual who opened these accounts with the bank, Sergei Roldugin, who is a Russian musician, had no viable, credible source of income, let alone the tens of millions of dollars that he invested in the bank. He was also known to be a close friend of Vladimir Putin. The investments were made 2014, 15, 16. So after the annexation of Crimea, this should have raised alarm bells. The bankers should have asked. This is what the judge said. And they are being fined because they failed to do so.
Swiss bankers, though, historically were famous for not asking questions.
That's right. But honestly, that's quite a long time ago. I mean, one thing that might be interesting here is that the bank concerned was in Zurich, but it was the Zurich branch of Russian Gazprom Bank. Now, it might have been that 20, 30 years ago, any Swiss bank would have taken that money, no questions asked. But the Swiss have, under enormous pressure, to be fair, international pressure, introduced some pretty strict money laundering and due diligence laws. And the conviction today is a sign that the Swiss judicial system, I think, wants to show its own financial sector, the Russians, and the rest of the world that they are actually enforcing these laws.
Imogen, folks. When David Beasley took on the job as the head of the World Food Programme 6 years ago, there were 80 million people who he said were marching towards starvation. He's since doubled the money it raises, and it's won a Nobel Prize. But as he stands down from the job, the number facing starvation has reached a staggering 350 million people. The worst global food crisis in living memory. The reasons? Conflict, climate change, COVID, and now the Ukraine war is disrupting global grain and fertiliser supplies. Sarah Montague spoke to David Beasley and asked whether he expects things will get even worse this year.
I would say it is going to get worse. And when you look at the last few years, when I took the role, 80 million people, and then it jumped to 135 before COVID. And that was because of war and climate shocks. Then COVID comes along and it goes from 135 million to 276 million. That's pre-Ukraine. And the economic devastation from supply chain disruption, et cetera, from COVID, as well as debt, and then the Ukraine war with pricing of food and fuel and inflation and devaluation of the currency, we're now at 345, 350 million people. And so here's what's really to put in context. 200 years ago, when there was only 1.1 billion people on planet Earth, you had about 95% of the people in poverty or extreme poverty around the world. Well, we've reduced that to less than 10%. But right now, Sarah, we're going backwards for the first time in hundreds of years.
The WFP is dealing with starving people in many parts of the world, from Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh to Haiti, Syria and Pakistan. But the place that always seems to be hardest hit by the drivers of hunger is Africa, not only from climate change, where it suffers more than any other region, despite being only responsible for 3% of global emissions, and from the Ukraine war, because it's so reliant on grain and fertilizer from Ukraine and Russia.
The poorest of the poor countries are impacted the most. And now we're talking about Africa. You're talking about a continent over a billion people. 70% of all the food that's consumed in Africa is grown, produced by smallholder farmers. The smallholder farmers can't afford the fertilizers if they can get them. So we're looking at a significant decrease of food production by the smallholder farmers in Africa. This is a continent, quite frankly, that ought to be feeding the rest of the world, but for a whole myriad of reasons, compounded by the fact that many countries in Africa depend upon Russian food, Russian fertilizer, and exports or imports from the rest of the world.
The organization is trying to raise $23 billion this year. So is the system sustainable, and how does the WFP decide who gets fed and lives and who dies?
Someone that said to me one day, you've got the greatest job on the planet, saving the lives of millions of people every day. And I said, I do, I really do. But I want to tell you something that's going to bother you. I don't go to bed at night thinking about the children we saved. I go to bed at night heartbroken about the children we couldn't save. When we don't have enough money, Sarah, we have to choose which children eat, which children don't eat, which children live, which children die. In Afghanistan right now, we literally just cut 4 million people in IPC level 4. In other words, they're knocking on famine's door. 50% rations. Syria, we're running out of money there. I can go on and on where we're running out of money. Short-term crisis, but we need long-term solutions, which include, of course, ending wars.
The outgoing head of the World Food Programme, David Beasley, and the full interview with Sarah Montagu will be available on the BBC iPlayer and BBC Sounds from Friday. Still to come, the Danish zoo trying to get its Chinese-owned pandas to mate.
They only have one oestrus period a year, and that is only somewhere between 24 and 72 hours, so it is a small window indeed.
North Korea is using public executions as a mechanism of spreading fear, says the government of neighbouring South Korea. In a new report issued by the country's new leader, Yoon Suk-yeol, previously classified information has been released that details how capital punishment is being used for even minor crimes, such as watching foreign films or observing religious practices. Various human rights groups frequently accuse the North Korean government of violations. It's less common for the South Korean government to divulge this kind of information. Rebecca Kesby spoke to Robert Kelly, Professor of Political Science at Pusan National University in Seoul, for more details on the report.
There are about 60,000 North Korean defectors who now live in South Korea, and there are other North Korean defectors scattered around the world. These people have been an important source of inside information about North Korea for a while now. They've spoken to non-governmental organizations and civic groups that work on human rights in North Korea. What's important here, I think, is that this is one of the first times that the South Korean government is really doing it. That's kind of geopolitically kind of risky because relations with North Korea are tricky, and this is the kind of thing that will activate a North Korean response. But there's a fair amount of defector testimony out there, and there has been for a while, and that's the primary source for this, the linguistic, right? And so the individual stories that have come out have been pretty shocking, but it's worth pointing out that these have been actually rumored for a long time. I mean, family executions and stuff like that.
They're saying that some of these executions have been for things as simple as just watching Western films. The inference is that it's to intimidate the public, to terrorize people in North Korea, to toe the line. Is that your understanding?
I think that's a fair read. A lot of the harshest punishments are for what the North Koreans call political crimes. Political crimes mean, you know, are pretty the reading is pretty capacious. We don't know a lot about the North Korean penal code, and you can imagine that it's not applied particularly fairly. But it seems like the primary weight of these really heavy penalties falls on any kind of show of disloyalty or not total commitment to the regime.
And you mentioned that it was significant that the South Korean government is involved in publishing these findings.
Right.
What are the
geopolitical
implications of that?
Yeah, so this is actually sort of an internal domestic debate in South Korea. We now have a conservative president. Conservative presidents in South Korea tend to be more hawkish on North Korea, and they're more willing to denounce North Korea in public on things like human rights and missile testing. South Korean liberal or progressive presidents have held their fire on these issues. They don't criticize North Korean human rights. And the South Korean left, has progressives, have long hoped that they could sort of push some kind of detente in North Korea, get some kind of reconciliation between the two. And so if you sort of follow South Korean politics, you can watch the presidency swing from right to the left, and you can see this issue of North Korean rights because it'll go up and down and up and down. So the law that was passed in 2016, which has led to this report, in 2016, you had a conservative government and the law was passed. Then you had a progressive government and they didn't implement the law, and this report, which was supposed to be published 7 years ago, just kind of disappeared into the bureaucracy. And now it's coming back out.
And is there any question mark over the verification of the information? You say it comes from defectors. Obviously, it's in their interest to try and impress the governments and the authorities wherever they end up with this kind of information, isn't it?
Right. And that's been a criticism from South Korean progressive groups of North Korean defectors for a long time, that they exaggerate stuff in order to get on TV. There's been criticism that a lot of them come and they join evangelical churches in South Korea, and they're sort of encouraged to sort of hype up how horrible North Korea is for sort of ideological or theological purposes. And to be fair to those critics, there have been cases where North Korean defectors, I think it's pretty clear, have exaggerated what experiences they went through.
Robert Kelly, Professor of Political Science at Pusan National University in Seoul. The Walt Disney Company and the Republican governor of Florida are not getting along, and in the long-running dispute between the two, Disney, it seems, has got the upper hand, using the British royal family as an aide. Here's our reporter, Rachel Wright.
Think of the happiest things. It's the same as having wings. To the stars beyond the blue.
Disney might well be thinking of the happiest things after they seemingly got the better of the Florida governor, Ron DeSantis. Let me take you back a bit. The Walt Disney Company has run the Florida district where Disney World is based for nearly 60 years. It does, after all, employ 75,000 people at the theme park. But in comes the new Republican Senator Ron DeSantis in 2018, and things change. They fall out in March last year after Disney criticised the Don't Say Gay law brought in by the Republicans to ban schools from teaching about sexual orientation and gender identity. Governor DeSantis didn't take the criticism well and loudly challenged Disney's control of the district where the theme park is based.
This state is governed by the interests of the people of the state of Florida. It is not based on the demands of California corporate executives.
So, back in February of this year, control of the area was handed to the newly created Central Florida Tourism Oversight District. Or so they thought. What they didn't know, or at least hadn't noticed, was that the outgoing Disney board, known as the Reedy Creek Improvement District, had inserted a legal clause which hands Disney total power over the development of the area using a declaration that is valid until 21 years after the death of the last survivor of the descendants of King Charles III, the current King of England. Royal clauses of this kind have been invented in order to be effective and almost impossible to challenge in court. And given King Charles already has 5 grandchildren, and they may well have grandchildren of their own, this clause may last a while. A member of the new board, Brian Ongst, isn't happy at all.
This development agreement, which in my opinion is void as a legal nullity, was passed the same day the Florida House passed the bill creating this board. And it was done to prevent us from doing our job. And that is offensive to me.
Disney hasn't commented. The new board, on the other hand, which thought it was about to take control in February, says it's consulting its lawyers.
Rachel Wright. The Oscar-winning actress Gwyneth Paltrow has won a US lawsuit after being sued over a skiing collision in Utah 7 years ago. The jury ruled that it was in fact the claimant, a retired optometrist, Terry Sanderson, who was at fault. He's been ordered to pay her a symbolic $1 in damages. Ms. Paltrow had insisted that she was the victim in the accident and had been hit from behind by Mr. Sanderson. He suffered several broken ribs and head injuries in the collision. Thomas Leeds wanted to be a writer as a child and at the age of 39 has published his first book. It's aimed at children, called Jaben and the Golden Torch. But his is not a typical story of a would-be author fulfilling an ambition, because at the age of 19, Thomas crossed a road in central London and was hit by a taxi. It caused a blood clot on his brain, and although he survived, he lost all the memories of his previous life. His story is fascinating, and some early memories did come back, and his story underpins the theme of his book. Evan Davis spoke to Thomas and started by asking him what his experience was like right after the accident.
Initially, I didn't know any different. So initially, it was just kind of, you know, everything was almost like being a baby again. So I didn't sort of know what you've forgotten until people start telling you, you know, everything's new, you know, waking up in this room that I didn't recognize and finding all this stuff that I didn't know that was, you know, mine or what it was. Obviously, it was very confusing because I didn't sort of know what was gone. You know, I just kind of took it one thing at a time and I didn't sort of question things, I don't think. I was just amazed by everything, especially ice cream. That was one of my favorite things.
Because you had to relearn what it was.
Yeah, and it was just magical, you know, like...
It's interesting that you didn't lose your ability to speak the language.
But I mean, over the years, obviously, I've learned a bit more about how this all works. So, for instance, most of the damage was on my right. And as far as I know, most of your language side, it is on your left side. It's amazing how differently the brain kind of records things. So what they call, I think, episodic memory, which is things happening, remembering that something's happened, is different to learning how to speak and how to walk. And again, with music, there does seem to just be something magical about the way it helps the brain remember. It's kind of tied into these to these memories. When I'd woken up from the accident initially, I'd found all these old essays and scripts and things I'd written before, and I found out that I used to love writing and that I'd been writing since I was about the age of 9. And so at the time, I was struggling to read and write. So after the accident, I couldn't read and write properly. So the idea of being a writer was something really hard to imagine. Then when those memories came back 10 years later, I got this idea for this story of this boy who wakes up with no memories in another world to discover that he has to be this hero. He has to go and find his memories in order to save the world from this villain who's taking everyone's memories. I was so determined to try and write this story. And my wife, Sophie, was like, yeah, do it. And it took me 2 years. Reading and writing was quite a struggle at the time, but I knew I could do it. And my sort of mantra at the time was, if it's not impossible, then you can do it. That book has now been published.
Is it you in the book?
So for a long time, I had wanted to see a story like this with somebody living with a brain injury and epilepsy in a mainstream sort of adventure story, because they're the sorts of stories I love. And the messages that I've been getting from families and with children who are living with seizures and memory problems, it's just been so amazing. They're hearing that they're enjoying the story. I think for any author, it would be a huge moment. But for me, it's kind of not just a personal victory to be a writer as I'd wanted to before, but also to show other people with brain injuries and memory problems and seizures, we can do these things too.
You've got kids, Thomas. What are they?
I do.
Do they like the book? Does it help them understand their father?
Yeah, my 7-year-old loves it.
Thomas Leeds speaking to Evan Davis. It's almost a modern cliché, the difficulty of getting two pandas to mate. A female panda is famously only fertile for around 2 days a year, and things are made worse by the fact that pandas are a determinedly solitary species. Advice on mating techniques for pandas in captivity is generally handed down as sacrosanct by China, which owns almost all the animals in question, including two pandas in Copenhagen Zoo in Denmark. But these two are currently being given a rare opportunity to get to know each other in the hope of romance blossoming. Mads Bertelsen, zoological director, explained the novel approach to Paul Henley.
We were listening to our experiences with other bears. So we've bred polar bears, brown bears, other bears for decades. And with them, we're pretty much allowing the animals access to each other a month or two before the mating season. And normally that results in a fairly harmonious coexistence of the animals and eventually normally leads to mating, which is what we're hoping for. But of course, it hasn't yet happened yet.
But there was a risk with pandas that they could not get on to the extent that they'd have a go at each other. They'd fight.
Absolutely. And indeed, pandas have killed each other. So we are keeping a very good eye on things and are keeping in touch with our Chinese colleagues also on the internet.
But it's an old-fashioned courtship we're talking about, is it? Get to know each other slowly.
Well, to an extent it is. If we turn to how pandas behave in the wild, what you will typically observe is that they do live alone all year. But then as mating season approaches, the male will sort of seek out the female. He'll keep a safe distance, but he'll sort of stay around, lurking in the distance, if you will. And then eventually she'll allow him closer and closer. Maybe she'll climb up a tree and sort of hold her position there until eventually the estrus does arrive and she'll climb down and they'll mate.
And there's only a tiny window for mating, isn't there?
There is. They only have one estrus period a year, and that is only somewhere between 24 and 72 hours. So it is a small window indeed.
And given the worldwide failure of zoos, comparative failure to get pandas to breed, you'd have thought that someone would have come up with your idea sooner, surely?
Well, it's not as simple as that. If you'll bear with me, if we rewind back to the 1970s, that was when the first worldwide census of pandas was made. And there were at that time about 2,500 pandas. 10 years later, that number had halved. And there was basically a big crisis. What are we going to do? How are we going to save the pandas? And two things were done. Large areas in China were set aside as natural reserves. And that has worked out really well. And then in the centers, the breeding of pandas were intensified. And the fundamental biology is that a female panda in a 2-year period will come into heat. She'll be pregnant. She'll give birth to two cubs, of which one will typically die and the other one will stay with her for 2.5 years or 1.5. So in a 2-year period, she'll have one cub. In captivity, what they did was they started taking these twins away from the mother, hand rearing it, and then later on coming up with a twin swapping procedure where one cub would be with mom and the other cub would be hand-raised. And then these cubs were removed from their mother at about 6 months of age, which it meant that in a two-year period, you could breed four cubs from one female. And that, of course, was a fantastic move in terms of making more pandas. But the price that we're paying now is that almost all of these pandas have been removed from their mothers much too early. And what we believe is that they just haven't learned the panda language. They don't really know how to behave as a panda.
So tell us about your newly non-solitary pandas and how they're getting on.
Well, so far, it's only been a few days, but so far, it's really looking very excellent. They are together, but they're not close to each other. They're keeping a distance of somewhere between, I guess, 10 and 30 meters. They have occasionally come closer, but only for brief moments. They know each other there. They seem to respect each other's boundaries. And so far, everything's looking very harmonious indeed.
Mads Bertelsen of Copenhagen Zoo. Keith Reid, whose enigmatic lyrics were crucial to the 1967 success of Procol Harum's A Whiter Shade of Pale, has died at the age of 76. Although he never performed with the band, he carried on writing for them well into the 21st century. Our music correspondent Mark Savage looks back at Keith Reid's career.
We skip the life and then go.
Fans have spent decades trying to decode the lyrics to A Whiter Shade of Pale. But Keith Reid said there was no deeper meaning. They were impressionistic, like a painting, always offering new levels of meaning. Born in Hertfordshire, he was inspired by classic literature and the lyrics of Bob Dylan. Outside Procol Harum, he scored a global hit in 1986 as the co-writer of John Farnham's Andy Warr anthem, You're the Voice. His death was announced on Procol Harum's Facebook page. In a statement, the family said he'd been receiving cancer treatment for several years.
Mark Savage. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Ricardo McCarthy, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.